From KQED Public Radio and the California Report, this is the Capital Notes podcast. Man, I'm tired for Friday, March 18th. That was Anthony York from the Los Angeles Times yawning.
No, I was stretching, man.
Well, stretching and yawning.
This is like post the morning after a big sprint or like running laps.
Yoga, you know.
No, this is a stretch, man. We've been through it. We've been through a mini cyclone. There was some sort of blustery event.
Well, let's examine the aftermath. I'm John Myers from KQED Public Radio, and we're talking about the week that was in the state budget drama here in Sacramento. I don't even really know where to start. I mean, you know, we can run down the numbers, the this, the that, and you know, okay, why not?
Well, that,
about $14 billion in solutions. Uh-huh. Cuts, transfers, delays, deferrals, shifts, blah, 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 blah.
We're halfway there. I mean,
roughly halfway there.
Right.
Roughly halfway there. But the second half.
Rounded to the nearest hole.
Yeah, but if you think the first half was hard, the second half is awfully hard.
Right. The easy stuff is done, right? Can we agree on that?
And it didn't feel that easy. I don't know, though. Actually, it was 2 days of debate. I didn't find it to be as torturous as some budget marathons go, in part because that's Democrats have a new option in their hands right now. They did for this part, which was a majority vote budget, which was the Prop 25 aftermath, where they switched a lot of bills to a majority vote and they moved them and they got it done.
Look, yesterday was a historic vote, right? The first time in, I don't know how long we've had a two-thirds budget in the state.
1933 is when it all.
Public radio.
Yeah.
That's what the federal government pays for, man. See, that kind of stuff. Anyway,
yeah, really.
Anyway. So since 1933, we have had two-thirds requirements for budgets. And this was the first. And quick math, public schools, 78 years, right? 78 years that we've had a majority vote budget. But it's not...
It was a two-step process, 1933 and then 1962. It's codified, okay, but you don't need to hear
footnotes,
all that.
No footnotes.
Doing it all off of coffee, baby. But it's been a long damn time.
And,
how about that?
And we've got a long way to go. I think, you know, we saw, you know, some thoughts about what we've just been through. The process seemed smoother in the Senate. And typically, so this is sort of the traditional division between the houses. You saw more Republican votes for cuts in the Senate. There was more of an ideological consistency in some ways to the Senate approach.
Though the Assembly went first in the bipartisan REAPs putting up the votes.
But the REAPs only put – and this is the difference between the Assembly and the Senate, right?
Yeah.
The Republicans in the Assembly only put up the minimum number of votes and only after every Democrat went up.
Right, right.
They wanted to make the point, depending on who you believe, that A, this is not a bipartisan product. This is a partisan Democratic budget, so we're – only going to offer the minimal support to the package as a whole. That's A. Or B, the Democrats accuse the Republicans saying, hey, this is about politics. They're making all of our members in marginal districts put up as many tough votes as possible because they want to knock them off in the elections after the new districts are drawn. Whatever the case, that is the tenor of the debate Assembly.
And I got to interrupt for a minute because, I mean, that to me is just such tremendous overthink on the part of Sacramento about what the public perceives.
Have you covered the Assembly, John?
Unfortunately, I have. But it is such true.
Well,
but it's tremendous overthink to the point, and I have another example as to where I'm coming to here. And we're probably going to jump around on issue to issue.
Because we're still picking up the pieces.
Yeah, we're processing. So, yeah. We've both been awake and on and on and on. But the overthink to me was also exemplified in the the fight we had over the criminal justice realignment on Thursday, which got testy and angry, and we'll talk about that maybe in a moment. But there was this whole thing of like, you know, well, can you do it in a majority vote? We want a ledge council opinion. The Senate did that, and that actually lasted fairly short. In the Assembly, after the ledge council had said, Democrats can move it on a majority vote, the Assembly Republicans continued to push the point, wanted to have a roll call vote, a parliamentary point of procedure. I was told by one person
that perhaps
it had some kind of, you know, precedent for a legal challenge. But it is such, I mean, and if that's what it was, that's great. If it was public perception, that it is such overthink that the public, I think, perceives this as a Democratic budget, Republican budget. I mean, the public is just going to evaluate the end product and whether something got done, I would
suspect. That is certainly the message that I think Democrats are pushing. Hey, look, it's time to be grown up. This is the governor's MO. It's time to be grown ups. Let's, you know, all band together and
but it's Democratic overthink too. I mean, I don't want to be bipartisan here because the whole push for the two-thirds vote was all overthink to me. I mean, because there was a point where I thought a lot of that had to do with an urgency measure.
But no, there's a loophole.
Yeah, because if you don't know this, folks, I mean, there's this whole thing about like often if you want something to take effect immediately, you have to have a supermajority vote. Otherwise, there's a 90-day lag. But that doesn't happen because when it's part of a budget, when it's a trailer bill, it goes into effect anyway.
Right.
And so the two-thirds was all – and again, sorry to my Democratic folks over in the Capitol – that was all political overthink to me about, you know, what the public would perceive. Republicans have skin in the game. Doesn't the public just evaluate this at the end of the day on the merits of the plan?
Yeah. Well, and I think we should back up for a minute
here.
And
I've gone way down a field. Go ahead.
And talk about what didn't happen this week. I mean, basically the easy stuff, the quote-unquote easy stuff was done. A lot of the cuts portion of the budget, depending on whose numbers you believe, $13 billion, I don't know.
And only in Sacramento would that be considered easy. I mean, this is $1 billion out of higher ed, CalWORKs, Medi-Cal, developmentally disabled. Right. Those are tough cuts, but politically easy. Right.
But the politically difficult pieces, number one, the redevelopment proposal. The governor wants to abolish redevelopment agencies and use about $1.7 billion from that to close this year's budget and then going forward wants
schools.
Property taxes to be funding schools and cities and counties. That got hung up in a strange partisan way that we will no doubt discuss here in a minute. And then, of course, the revenues and the whole notion of a special election ballot. The idea of extending taxes, of changing the implementation of the single sales factor, all of the things that would bring money into the budget, those things are caught up and those are That's still the major, major contentious issue out there.
And those
there
are all two-thirds issues. I mean, redevelopment.
We're early in the process.
But that is the way it's been laid out. Redevelopment, the business tax break, the special election tax issue, all two-thirds issues in some way, shape, and form. And that's why those didn't get done.
Right.
At the top.
As constructed, the redevelopment. We can talk about, if we want, why.
Well, let's talk about the redevelopment now.
Okay.
Because first of all, there was a lot of arm twisting. You've already alluded to that. So let's talk about that. I want to say that I think you tell me, too. You ever seen a governor work a vote like that?
Sit camped out in the speaker's office.
In the time that you've been around here, I mean, I was here briefly and saw Wilson, and I didn't see. And Wilson was a more active governor, from what everybody tells you. I never saw do something like that. Schwarzenegger never once would have really done it that way.
But this is. I mean, some of it's a turf issue. What Jerry Brown does, what past governors have not done that I've seen, is he meets the legislators on their turf. Now, whether he's challenging them on their home court or. But he doesn't use the office. You know, normally people get summoned to the governor's office, right? I mean, it's the big thing. And I think in some ways this approach is a more parliamentarian approach to governing, perhaps a more egalitarian approach to governing, that you're not going to get caught up on the hang-ups of being. So he's camped out being the governor. So he camps out in the speaker's office, the governor and the speaker – tried for a couple of hours on Wednesday night, I think that was.
Wednesday afternoon,
And into Wednesday evening to try to get a second Republican to support the governor's plan to eliminate redevelopment agencies.
And first he had to get all the Dems, and he walked in the non-voting Dems one by one. Anthony Portantino,
Tony Mendoza, Luis Alejo, I believe, was there.
And he got them. He got all 52 Dems in the assembly.
Right.
And then he already had Chris Norby from Orange County because he's hated redevelopment, I think, since time began.
So
that was an easy one. But he could not get that 54th vote.
No, and there were, Republicans were called in. Jim Nielsen, the ranking Republican on budget issues, who gave a floor speech talking about all the evils of redevelopment and then and then voted to protect them. It was a very strange.
And Nielsen
strange
and Brown
moment.
Have a comity that's unlike a lot of people that or at least they play it that way. You're skeptical, and that's fair enough. But at least in like, you know, when Brown went to the budget conference committee,
right,
you know, that shows that they're at least, I guess, is my point here, Anthony, his skepticism notwithstanding.
You've hit upon something that frustrates me.
But they are from a okay. I know you think there's a lot of optics here, and I appreciate it.
Yes.
I know that's what you're thinking. See, I know you. But they are from a different era of the political world where the game was played differently.
Right. And Nielsen, a former Senate Republican leader, I believe when Brown was governor.
Yeah.
No?
Yeah. Yeah. They talked. Yeah. I mean, so they're from an era where the game was played somewhat differently than it is now. That was my.
And yet the result is so refreshingly modern.
So we couldn't get. So he couldn't get Nielsen. He couldn't get. Did he try to get any other Republican on redevelopment?
Yes. Kacho Ashajian.
Ashajian. Yeah. From San Luis Obispo.
Your hometown guy.
Yeah.
There was a third that if you talk and ask me a question, I'll remember.
That's okay.
Who the third one was.
The point is, he was not able to dislodge a 54th vote in the assembly. And as a result, redevelopment, the RDA abolishment, never went to the Senate either. It remains theoretically stuck in the assembly. Right. I don't know if you'd have to take the vote over because we've had.
And there is, look, the governor has some tools in his back pocket here to eliminate. Redevelopment agencies can be eliminated on a majority vote.
But
in order to achieve the 1 year budget savings to offset $1.7 billion in cuts to courts and Medi-Cal, which the governor wants to do with the money this year, that requires a two-thirds vote. So going forward, the governor and the legislature on a majority vote could eliminate redevelopment agencies and divvy up that $1.9 billion, roughly, in property tax between schools, cities, counties, and special
districts. Or let's put it this way. He can close the store on a majority vote. He can't actually get the cash out of the register,
right?
Unless he's got a two-thirds vote, or as one Democrat,
I'm sure there are many that would carry out that analogy a little further.
The redevelopment supporters would make it a bank robbery.
Yes.
I'm not necessarily saying it could be in a foreclosure. I mean, it could be, you know, my analogy goes all kinds of places. But one Democratic staffer put it to me as the sense that we can't get the money without a two-thirds vote,
right?
And therein lies the governor's challenge.
And I don't know what you think, but I mean, given the governor's, my read of the governor's temperament, and maybe he'll check in with us today.
The dog's coming over.
I wouldn't be surprised if there was it's an aggressive option. And it wouldn't shock me if that lever gets pulled by the time this process is over.
Which is what, to just close them up?
Yeah.
And then
with no budget savings.
Yeah, and then leave the money almost as a okay.
Yeah.
Well,
I mean, I don't know. You know.
Well, we don't really know what the end game is going to be on a lot of stuff, and we don't know. So we don't know the end game on RDA.
There's a major.
Just
major
like we don't know the end game on the special election issue,
right?
Which did not come up this week. So in our week in review, this is not part of the week in review. But it is still floating out there, the whole issue of the $11 billion that have to go on the ballot. And that's not the only revenue. I mean, actually, I had a person who was a very smart Twitter follower who said, isn't it more money than $11 billion? Yes, but the $11 billion represents what's on the ballot. Then there's also the single sales factor tax break,
and
other stuff,
tax,
yada,
swap,
yada, yada.
Which did come up.
We don't know what the ultimate end game is on the special election either. I mean, the Republicans are... And I think in a way that is very valid. I mean, you know, I want to be observant of the both sides have good points and bad points here. Republicans did make an interesting point on Thursday, or Sam Blakesley, Republican from San Luis Obispo, who's one of the GOP 5.
That was a lot of air quotes.
Which is, yeah.
Or
which
were
is,
they bunny foo-foos?
They really need a better name.
Yeah.
Your friends at Capital Weekly, did they ever get one?
I don't know.
They were having a contest.
Yes.
But Blakesley on the floor on Thursday said, look, just move it on a majority vote. You've got a legal opinion that says you can put them on the ballot without us. Go ahead and do it. And Democrats don't want to do that for optics reasons. However, I do wonder if there is a point where the Democratic point of view is that cutting $26 billion is horrible.
Yes.
And it is morally wrong. It is, I mean, you know,
Democrats aren't the only ones who believe that. I mean, Bill Berryhill this week was quoted.
But my point being, if Democrats truly believe that the $26 billion option of cuts is horrible, then wouldn't they do anything to keep that from happening, which would be, okay, we can't get the Republicans. Let's call the election without them.
Yeah, we're not there yet.
Well, when are we going to get there?
Well, I think
that
a lot of this is about optics. I mean, look, this whole deadline-driven situation right now is all about politics. There's nothing in the Constitution that says you need an election.
Politics from the governor's race,
right,
from Brown.
That was a vow that the governor made during the race. There's no rule that says you need to have the election before July 1st. But for political reasons, before July 1st, these are tax extensions. After July 1st, once the taxes roll back, and so it would be tax increases, and those semantical differences make huge differences in the polling. And so that is why this week was a deadline week, we are within this deadline window. It's a window to have an election before no later than June 28th, and so I think that's part of the Republicans' frustration, And frankly, I'm hearing that from some interest groups on the Democratic side as well.
Yeah, I wanted to talk about that because I do think there is a percolating sense out there that from those folks who normally align themselves with the Democratic viewpoint about some of these funding issues to say, why are we doing this?
Right. And we discussed this a little bit last week.
But let's just go ahead, go for the other option, and let's come back first of all, we don't think the voters may even pass all of this, and we've seen some polling that raises questions about that. Right. Let's just wait till next year where we can have a real election, vote the people in we want, yada, yada, yada.
Yeah, but that would involve in some ways Jerry Brown reneging on his word, either reneging on his word to sign taxes without a vote of the people, or reneging on his word to not do any more budget gimmicks and to kick this can down the road for another 18 months until we have this fight at the ballot box and see what the redistricted legislature looks like. The governor doesn't want to do either one of those things, and I think I can safely say that, not to speak for the governor, but my perception is that the governor doesn't want to do either of those things. And so we'll see. I mean, I've covered this place for 15 years, and my ability to instinctually try to figure out where this is headed is totally gone. I mean, I just don't have a really good read on how this resolves itself. Do you?
No. I mean, I feel as though there's just no way that inside the governor's horseshoe offices or upstairs in the Democratic majority leadership offices that somebody's not sitting around thinking very seriously about what the plan B is and how they will get to plan B if things start very soon. I don't think there's a lot of time left on plan A. I just don't think so. I don't think you have an election. Let me say why real quickly. Yeah. I don't think you have an election on June 28th. I think it's too late. I think it misses speaking of optics, it misses the governor's entire mentality of the pre-July 1st decision from the voters. You've said before yourself, I believe I'm quoting you and others, that the governor loses a pressure point with that July 1st, after July 1st thing about legislative salaries and all of that part of Prop 25. So I think the 28th is really late. I think the 21st is probably late. But let's, just for sake of argument.
Those are both better than tax increases, aren't they?
Yeah, but for sake of argument, I think if you go more than another 10 days.
Right.
And you're nowhere further than you are now. What is the point of continuing to beat your head against the Plan A board?
Right. What extent is there a Plan B? I mean, the governor has said all along, that Plan B is,
Plan B is a Democratic only vote on an election because it keeps the governor's campaign. And this is just me guessing, folks. I don't have any intel on this because people are suspiciously hands up in the air, or maybe they're just truly hands up in the air when you ask them this inside the Capitol.
Right.
But I think it keeps the governor's overarching macro political promise intact. He never promised to go to the ballot with Republicans and Democrats. He just promised to go to the ballot.
Right.
It keeps that intact. It puts the question out there. I think it's a debatable point.
Way.
It's a debatable, but in a partisan way. But it's a debatable point whether the forces that actually have money to kill that election will come forward, even then. I mean,
they would have to come from, I believe, from outside California. I mean, and so whether that happens,
and are those
I don't
people
know.
Really going to spend that money?
And how much does it take? Well, it's interesting because, again, getting back to the politics of it, threading the needle here to try to pass these tax extensions is tough. The governor believes that the best way, again, not to – I should paraphrase here rather than speak definitively about what
you
the governor
said
believes.
You know what the governor feels. Maybe
I know.
Channeling
the governor. Well, this is my beat, right? So I feel like I've got this right.
Have you
Someone
done the
Vulcan
mind meld with him, you know, where Mr. Spock puts his hands up?
Okay. No, though – well, anyway. but that –
If I give you too many openings for randomness,
let's
you
move
get
on.
Off your
let's
point.
Move on here. Yes. So, I think to move forward, the governor wants to their team wants the best possible option, the most likely option, the easiest thing to pass is something that is tax extensions, not tax increases, and that has bipartisan buy-in. But I do think you're right. I think that Plan B has to be some kind of majority vote election that will have been constructed through some sort of loophole and gimmick, and is not the ideal situation for Team Brown to enter into this election with a short turnaround and to try to sell this. But I think we should point out now that that hypothetical election, that scenario, would be very different than 2009. What we had in 2009 was a very confusing ballot with centrist buy-in, both on the Democratic side and on the Republican side. You had business groups and teachers unions in support of this convoluted mishmash of measures. But then outside of that, you had opposition not only from the Howard Jarvis Taxpayers Association on the right, but the Service Employees International Union on the left. And so that was funded opposition. That was and there was so much confusion about that ballot that I think the collective weight of all of that and objections on the left and the right and that short window, all of those events helped really doom that election. And so it would be a different election here. It would be a mistake to assume that this kind of, non-bipartisan route, this more partisan route would be a replay of 2009.
And I think too, I will quickly be proved wrong here, I'm sure, but there's so many things out there that this gets back to my rant at the top of the podcast about the way Sacramento perceives the world and the way the rest of California perceives issues. I mean, this is a state that only has 30% of the voter registration are Republicans. It's not a state that perceives that Republicans are in a position of power. And they haven't given them that power. And people can beat all the polling up all they want, and I think polls are only snapshots in time. But look at the decline to state voters. Look at the nonpartisan voters. They, too, don't have any problem with an election. Right. And so it just depends. It obviously depends who turns out for the race, to vote. It depends how the governor frames the issue. But that does get me to a point I wanted to make quickly, which is that early in Jerry Brown's tenure, which feels like it was it was only 2 months ago. It feels like it was 2 years ago at this point. Mm-hmm. I had written a couple of things, and I feel they were really rather reasonable things to say, that perhaps the governor's education about what had happened since he had left provided a way to educate the public about what's going on with their government. And I wonder, though, whether the governor has done enough of that legwork to be able to stand on this campaign at this point.
I worry.
Because it's not really my thing. But I worry for the public. I worry for the larger, broader sense.
For the children.
I do wonder whether he has spent so much time with the inside game here in Sacramento that he hasn't spent a lot of outside game time with the public.
Yep.
You know, he started off that way with a couple of budget hearing explanatory events. But at a certain point, you've got to convince the skeptical public that he really needs the money. The polling still shows that people are not completely convinced that Sacramento politicians need the cash.
It sounds like you're having the same conversations that I'm having.
Mm. With myself?
Perhaps. but I think that there's something there, and that when we all look back on and write the histories of the special election of 2011, I think something tells me we may be circling back to that point. Maybe not. And I was just having this discussion with somebody last night that there's a difference between, I mean, how many ballot initiative campaigns has Jerry Brown been involved in? I don't know the answer to that. I know the Political Reform Act, right? Prop 9.
That was 1974.
Right. And there are a couple. But point being that running a political campaign is very different than running an initiative. An initiative campaign is very different than a candidate campaign. Brown could run a 60-day campaign for governor, essentially, because in part he did do some of the spade work beforehand. But he also was the personification of a brand, right? The Jerry Brown political brand. It's very different with an initiative, and especially if you're running a yes campaign, it's always easier to defeat something, and it's always confusing to try to explain it to people, and it takes time. And so the question is, have people gotten enough of an education about what's going on, the fight over tax extensions, and that they won't be surprised when they see it, or are they going to react to it, turn around here in a couple of weeks and see it and say, what is this? What are they doing? I'm voting no again.
And I think one example of that was a private poll that you and I both saw, because I saw your name on the email chain as well.
Oh, that one.
Yeah, that one. But a private poll for people who were looking for good news out of the voters approving the tax extensions. And I think it largely mirrored the public field poll that said people at this point are, barely those surveyed willing to consider the tax extensions. But when the question that caught my eye, you probably know where I'm going, is the question of saying which one of these arguments it appealed to you, which one of these arguments do you believe most? Without this money, things will be cut horribly, blah, 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 blah. Or this is a tax increase that we really can't afford at a whatever time. That one was the one that worked. And I think it showed that an opposition campaign has a much easier time, even if it's not a real opposition campaign, if it's just the mindset that the voters walk into with.
Yep.
And all of that, again, to me, goes to this education of the voters. Can the governor educate them in the time he has? He's a persuasive guy. He's willing to debate people up and down the state. I think at a certain point that will work, and then it may be too much. But the longer this goes on in Sacramento, the less time he has to do that. It's a very tough case.
But because he hasn't been barnstorming the state for the last 2 months, there's this idea that is a holdover from his gubernatorial campaign that one of the reasons they beat Whitman is because they were fresh and new come September. Maybe he's saving himself. But the question is whether there's sort of whether the seeds are being sown among organized labor, communicating with their members, whatever the churning of the Democratic political machine, for lack of a better term, are those machines in motion? I don't know. I mean, I don't get the sense that they are in the way that you're talking about, but what do we know?
What do we know? It's been a bit of a long podcast, but I don't want to end without us talking a little bit about the state Republican Party convention this weekend. Because some of the people who will be listening will say, hey, what do we make of that convention?
And the question is, did we not have a tax vote because this convention is being held this weekend in Sacramento?
We will never know. Well, maybe we will sometime if you can get somebody to finally fess up on those kinds of issues. Because, since we've said optics about 400 times in this podcast, that was one that was continually talked about. Would that put a very strange pressure on Republicans who might be willing to do something when the party faithful are across the street at the Hyatt Hotel from the Capitol? But so they're coming into town. Today's Friday. They're coming in today. They're here through the weekend. I want to talk briefly about what influence, if any, that has on the process, this, you know, for years, for good gosh, two decades, decade and a half. I mean, you know, I'm thinking of those, you know, thinking back to Prop 187.
94.
Yeah, 94. The party has been having an internal war, moderate, conservative, but it's largely social issues.
Right.
Now I feel like it's a true, just the flat out moderate conservative spectrum. Right.
Business versus thing. Taxpayers. That's sort of been my, I've had the same thought.
And yeah. so which case, I mean, what comes of that this weekend? There are a couple of different ways to measure that. There is the California Republican Assembly, the internal group, the core conservative part of the party, probably, who again want to censure anybody who would vote for the special election.
But they filed it too late, apparently.
Did they?
Apparently. We'll talk later.
Okay. Yeah. Well, we'll talk later. Come on, it's the podcast.
That's what I heard. I don't know. I heard that resolution may not be coming to the floor.
But they pushed that issue in 2009 about people who voted for the taxes
to
in the
censure
legislature.
Them, yes.
Yeah, the censure issue. So that's one way to measure it. I would argue the Prop 14 fight is a way to measure it as well this weekend. There's a measure moving forward. You remember the open primary, or the top two primary, I should call it, that's now in effect, where it doesn't matter what your party is. Whoever gets the most votes goes to the November election. The Republican Party apparatus did not like this from the get-go. And so there has been this effort underway to allow the party to officially endorse a Republican candidate, even if there are multiple Republican candidates in that field in a contest. Am I saying this right? To officially endorse before the election. A moderate wing of the party doesn't want to do that. The more conservative wing of the party wants to do that. I think that's another way to measure this, because the conservatives are arguing, one in particular who has a website, mm-hmm. who penned a very long editorial on his website the other day that said, you know, why do we want moderates? Why do we want to be moderate? I mean, effectively saying, why do they want to water down the party? That's a very interesting question
the Republican Party has to
figure out for itself.
And the answer obviously is contained in that stat you cited earlier in the podcast, where 30% of the state's voters are registered Republican.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, that's what the moderates say is, hey, we can't grow the party unless we have build the big tent, right? So, yeah, that fight's been going on a long time.
But moderate conservative, you know, pure philosophy versus pragmatism, it's a very interesting time to have a convention that theme is going on at the same time we're having, in some ways, that kind of fight over the Capitol, too.
Well, I mean, I don't think that's a coincidence. I think that's the same thing. That's why the voters approved redistricting. That's why the voters approved the top two primary, I think. I mean, narrow margins, but I think that there's been some frustrations with the way that both parties have operated over the past decade by some folks in the middle, by some moderates, and that, you know, they cite the root of that as the last gerrymander, the 2001 gerrymander that was a bipartisan deal that protected incumbents in both parties. And the result, conventional wisdom, what gets often repeated, whether it's right or not, is that system empowered the more extreme wings of both parties, that you created Republican districts where only more conservative candidates could get elected. You created Democratic districts where more liberal candidates could get elected. And that's what the campaigns for redistricting changes and the top two primary have been railing against. And so the parties obviously want to control as much of this process as they can. So what we're seeing this weekend here is a threat to their control, a threat to the activist control of the party. What it means ultimately, and will any of these changes that voters have approved have a tangible impact or change on how Sacramento works?
Yeah, who knows?
Yeah, we'll be talking about that in about 5 years, I guess.
Yeah, yeah. If that, I mean, yeah, we'll have to. There's a long run issue there.
Yeah.
So with that,
That didn't feel like it helped.
Yeah, you were looking for some kind of sorting it all out before we started. Anthony walked into the studio and he's like, I can't have it sorted this all out yet. Maybe I can do it in the podcast.
No.
Have you sorted it all out?
No, I don't feel very organized. Although you have convinced me of some things on the campaign.
And I just came up with those, I don't know, organically.
It's
dangerously.
Dangerous.
All right, with that, we'll try not to be too dangerous until next week. For Anthony York from the LA Times, I'm John Myers from KQED. See you next time.